somebody appeals, they might get a better deal than somebody that doesn't have the wherewithal, either mentally or financially, to appeal. I mean, usually we don't make competency determinations based on whether an appeal was good or an appeal was not good in regard to erroneous exercise of discretion or whatever at the circuit.
So, I mean, with regard to the second part of the question, you know, there are always winners and losers in the appellate process based on who pursues the appeal and who doesn't, and quite frankly, not sure how to solve that with this case. But with regard to the first part of your question, what I heard you echoing was, in some sense, JWK's holding. JWK notes, listen, just because this the original commitment was subsequently deemed unlawful does not mean that an extension order entered before the original commitment was deemed unlawful is unlawful too, right? We don't retroactively strip the circuit court of competency. And what that principle shows is that competency is about the here and now for circuit courts. Competency is about right now, does the circuit court have statutory authority to exercise its subject matter jurisdiction in the case at hand? And what I'm arguing is that 9, 10, 11 months down the line, while maybe the circuit court had competency at the time it entered the extension order, that competency cannot spring back to life 9, 10, 11 months later. It is tethered to the preceding commitment when the question is competency to hold an extension hearing. That's what GOT and JWK make clear. All right, I have, I believe, just a couple minutes left, so I'm just going to quickly touch on the DJW harmless error question without talking about the substance of the DJW issue, since I am short on time. I want to note what it means to apply the harmless error rule to a DJW violation. And I see it as telling reviewing courts to search the record to determine whether sufficient evidence of a particular standard of dangerousness has been proven. That searching is what reviewing courts did pre-DJW, searching and guessing, sometimes confidently, instead of reviewing explicit, specific, on-the-record decisions. Applying harmless error by telling courts to go back to the pre-DJW world and search the record effectively nullifies that DJW directive, or at least turns it into a suggestion with no teeth. So I would ask this court to clarify that DJW is not amenable to harmless error, that when it comes to establishing the record, making the record, clarifying for the subject of a Chapter 51 proceeding in the moment why their liberty is being taken away, and clarifying on the record so that an appellate court can do their job appropriately in reviewing that decision.
But the requirement in DJW is not statutory. That's an add-on by this court. You won't find those words in the statute, correct?
Correct. Correct, and
was
I do...
Was the underpinning constitutional?
Yes.
Yeah.
Liberty is what's at stake, and it's... You know, the...
Or sometimes it's treatment. We've had people that have died during the time when we've been trying to figure out the liberty issues up here. People
fortunately,
who
I've represented
treatment.
One of those clients.
Yes, right. I you do this work a lot, and I'm surprised you've only had one. Because oftentimes the people that are subject to these orders are so very fragile.
I would agree with that. And I think given their fragility, it is all the more important to be diligent in the procedures that are used to strip them of their liberty, to treat them with dignity by explaining those decisions, and to treat them with dignity by creating a record that an appellate court can review and ensure that they are getting the due process due to them. Thank you.
Thank you.
Jenny Iverson.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court. There are three issues before the Court today. The first being whether EJW applies retroactively. This Court should find that it does not. The second being whether the Circuit Court complied with the requirements of DJW. This Court should find that it did. And the third being whether outright reversal is always the appropriate remedy. This Court should find that it is not. I would like to begin with the retroactivity of EJW. As the appellant stated, and I agree, generally new rules of law in civil cases apply retroactively. However, this Court has recognized in Chapter 51 cases, as well in other cases, that inequities occur when new rules of law are applied retroactively, because retroactive application of a new rule is unsettling because of justifiable reliance on the contrary view of the law. That's why this Court adopted the Kurtz factors, which lays forth three factors that should be met in order to apply a new rule of law retroactively.
Counsel, I'm going to ask you the same question that I asked your friend on the other side. Neither of you briefed the Harper case, but it was 30 years ago that the United States Supreme Court abandoned the Chevron factors, which we adopted in Kurtz, because retroactivity actually, Justice Holmes in an earlier case said, goes back 1,000 years, and prospective application of the law is inconsistent, as Justice Scalia said in the Harper case, is inconsistent with the judicial role, which is not to make the law, but to declare it. So I understand your position to be asking us to apply a law that it never was the law, it was invalid, according to the Court. So you're asking us to apply something that is invalid. And instead, I think you are both asking us to apply the equities. But as I said to your friend on the other side, how are we supposed to do that? Because we seven people see equities differently and would balance them differently. It's completely subjective. So why don't we just return to what was, as Justice Holmes said, the law for 1,000 years or the rule for 1,000 years, retroactivity?
Thank you, Your Honor. I also am not familiar with that case law, but I understand the Court's concern with applying inequities and how those may come out. I do think that this Court should continue to apply them because there is justifiable reliance on the contrary view. Especially in this case, the Court relied upon RJO, the law at the time that this hearing was held, and now going back and applying EJW does have some unsettling results. So I would ask that the Court continue to apply the Kurtz factors, which it has applied since then, including in State XRL Buswell versus Toma Area School District, which I rely on, and I think there are similarities between this case and that case.
Ms. Iverson, in your, I want to go back to, I think, what you were talking about before, and I think it was the inequities. I'm just going to steer you in that direction. In reading your brief, you talk about a couple of inequities. One is on the bottom of page 14. And you say, if the goal of EJW is to protect subjects' due process rights, applying the rule retroactively does not further that goal, as those individuals have already had their rights violated and there's no remedy that could repair that. And then you cite Buswell. In reading that, I'm having a hard time with that argument. It's like, yeah, you know what? We've already violated some people's due process rights, so, you know, we should just violate everyone's due process rights because that would be the most equitable. I don't think that's what you meant, but it's possible perhaps to read it that way. And then on the next page, your argument to me is a little bit similar, and you talk about that there are countless individuals who are currently subject to a Chapter 51 commitment, and those were orders that were entered before this Court decided EJW, who would have requested a jury trial within 48 hours of their rescheduled commitment, but they didn't because their attorneys relied on RJO for that 18-month period. And those individuals don't have a remedy. So, again, the argument sounds a little bit like, well, you know, some folks aren't going to get this, and so we should just make sure nobody gets that. And that argument isn't sitting all that well with me. And I'm realizing I might be not characterizing it as favorably as I could. So will you push back on the way I'm interpreting what you're saying here?
Sure.
Please?
I think maybe phrasing it better in terms of if we look at EJW and what that goal in EJW was, it was to provide subjects their right to a jury trial. That's what this court ultimately decided. And I think applying that retroactively, for example, to Michael, it doesn't give him a right to a jury trial. He can't have a jury trial at this time. His commitment is expired. So it doesn't further that rule. It doesn't further the goals, because going back in time, we can't go back in time. And I think that the court in Buswell noted that as well when they said that you couldn't go back in time and allow individuals to attend properly noticed hearings because those hearings had already taken place. So I think that, in that way, it doesn't further EJW. Applying it to Michael does not further the goal.
But your argument is that I thought it's an can you tie that into the argument that that makes it inequitable? You really are just saying because in this case Michael appealed his case, he's in a different position than someone might be then who did not appeal their case, but and that happens all the time, right? The person who appeals their case and because they appealed their case, we declare that the law is different or we interpret something differently than we have in the past.
Sure. So the inequities exist within subjects, within 51s who, like I said, didn't appeal or could or didn't ask that the court have a jury trial. I think that the inequities also are probably stronger in terms of inequities against the county in applying the rule retroactively, which sort of goes into that third factor and how they interrelate. If we were to apply EJW retroactively, it does open the county up for potential liability. It calls into question the actions that we took at the time, even though we were relying upon.
Okay, so let's talk about that, right? Like, is that a reason for us not to do the right thing because we're afraid that the county, I mean, that sounds like that shouldn't be something that we should be concerned about. Right? I mean, if the county did something that was unlawful or illegal and, you know, someone wanted to take that to court, I mean, we shouldn't really be stepping in the way of that. I mean, why should I be, I guess, I don't mean to say this like too bluntly, but why should I care about that when I'm making this decision here?
Sure. I would, again, go back to Buswell in that it was enough in that case. This court noted that there was a potential for opening the county up to calling into question their actions, opening the county up to liability, and just the possibility of that, this court weighed very heavily in that decision in deciding to apply the law prospectively only. And I want to go back to 51 as a treatment statute. It's not a punitive statute. When the county makes these actions, it's with the goal of protecting the public safety and protecting individuals. And when we make those and act that way, if we can now go back in time and subjects can call into question our actions because we relied on, well, good law at the time, which we now know is no longer good, I think that is an inequity and it is concerning.
So is your position that we would never apply any case, any decision would never be applied retroactively in a Chapter 51 case, because all the arguments you've made would apply to any changes that we would possibly ever make to the law in a Chapter 51.
I don't know about all of the time, but this I will note in DJW the court only applied that holding going forward, so I think that it would make sense. There is precedent for this court to only apply Chapter 51 holdings going forward.
I would assume that part of that rationale involves the disruption and the reliance factors. Some questions have raised the whether or not we should stick to three factors set out in Chevron and Kurtz. I say let's embrace the six factors that former Justice Thomas Fairchild set forth in a seminal article on sunbursting. And at least a couple of those, again, deal with has it been relied upon? Or the fifth one, what is the extent of disruption from which would result from retroactive application? Let me ask a leading question. Don't you agree that those are factors of import when deciding whether or not it should be a prospective or retrospective application?
Yes, I think that those factors would, especially in this case, weigh, and I think they would weigh in favor of prospective application only. If you look at disruption, at the time that this case was before the Court of Appeals, it could have been remanded for a new jury trial. There was time. What that would have looked like, it would have been difficult. It could have been done, but it would have raised a lot of questions about the evidence that would come in. The circuit court would have to clear its schedule. It would be disruptive. And I think those factors may weigh to the inequity in as well that are in the three factors in Kurtz. And what does this look like applying it retroactively?
Aren't we only talking about a small amount of cases that were trapped within the time period that RJO was the law? And what kind of disruption are you, what kind of reliance are you talking about? And what kind of disruption are you talking about if we're talking about a few individuals who did not get the benefit of the correct interpretation of the statute that we now have and who were trapped in the RJO 18 months or whatever that time frame was?
I don't know the exact number of individuals who this would apply to. I know that in our county, this is the only one that it applies to. We're on the smaller side of counties. So, for example, in Milwaukee County, I don't know how many people it would apply to, but I think that in small counties, it would be a disruption applying it retroactively.
Well, you just said this is the only case. So tell me what you're arguing fits with the reality of the situation. What's the disruption? What's the reliance? What are they?
If the Court of Appeals would have decided the case and it would have been retroactive application and we would have had a new jury trial, we would have had to drop everything to figure out what.
No, we're saying now. We are about to decide now. Are we applying this retroactively or prospectively? So now, if this court says we are going to apply this retroactively in conjunction with the presumption, in conjunction with the factors or not the factors, however we say it, what is the disruption that you're saying is going to take place? What is the reliance that should counsel us to not do that?
At this time now, it could not be remanded for a new jury trial. It's expired. If the court does decide to apply EJW retroactively, then reversal is the appropriate remedy here. So there would be no disruption in this case at this time.
Thank you.
I would like to move on to DJW. Regardless of how the court decides the EJW issue, I would ask that the court reach DJW, because DJW has created confusion at the Court of Appeals level and circuit courts since it was decided, and these issues often evade review. I personally have 4 appeals pending that involve DJW issues, and so I would ask that the court provide clarity on that topic. So in DJW, the court noted that circuit courts have a duty to ground their factual findings regarding dangerousness into one of the 5 subdivision paragraphs of 5120. The purpose of that is to provide increased protection to subjects so that they know which standard they are being found dangerous under, and it's also to help clarify issues that are raised on appeal. When you look at the facts of this case, I think the circuit court complied with DJW. DJW says that the court must reference one of the subdivision paragraphs. It does not say the court must state the number and the letter that it is finding the dangerousness under. It's enough that it ties its findings back. In this case, the record shows that Michael knew which standard of dangerousness he was being found dangerous under. The doctor in this case filed a report, which was admitted into evidence, that the court relied upon and also testified. In testifying, the doctor said that, in his opinion, Michael was a danger to himself or others through judgment impaired by paranoid psychosis. that being subsection C of 5120 sub 1 sub A. In their closing argument, the county argued that at the current time, Michael was a risk of harm to himself or others through judgment impaired by paranoid psychosis. In his brief in support of his motion for consideration, Michael, through his counsel, recognized that the court found that he was a danger due to the risk of harm to himself and others through judgment impaired by paranoid psychosis. Unlike DJW, where the court had to look into the record and couldn't figure out which standard was relied upon, and in DJW, the parties argued different standards at each level of appeal. Here, that's not the case. It's been the same since the finding in the circuit court through now that it was the subsection C which was relied upon. Michael knew that, and that's what the court found.
Where did the court make the if not specific, inferential finding?
So the court noted that Michael was a danger to himself and others due to the events that had occurred in January of 2021, which it referenced numerous times what those events were. It noted that he was incredibly dangerous not only to Michael but to other people too. It again, over and over again, said dangerous to himself and others. It did not say due to the paranoid psychosis, which is what the doctor, the county, and the defense said. However, if you look at the three sections, the only one that says danger to self and others is subsection C. So again, Michael knew why he was being recommitted. He knew the standard he was being found under. This court doesn't have to go digging through the record to figure that out.
I pause because the Michael knew why argument to me doesn't resonate. And it doesn't resonate because the inquiry isn't in and of itself, hey, did the person really know? I mean, did they have some cheating notes that gave them the outline of everything and they really knew? You know, we're not looking at that. We're looking at what the circuit court has to do for the reasons set forth in the opinion. And so Michael really knew why doesn't resonate. But you point out that the circuit court several times did make reference to danger to himself and others, which is part of the C of the statute.
Yes.
So it seems to me that's what you should be relying on rather than Michael really knew why. Can you respond to that? Because a couple of times in your argument now, in your response, you've emphasized that Michael really knew why.
Sure. I think that in DJW, the court was trying to make sure that subjects, it again goes back to their due process rights and making sure that they are aware of what the court is finding. And so to your point, yes, the court in this case did make adequate findings to tell him what they were finding.
Let me just be clear, that's not my point. But I'm just incorporating that in my question. Of course, that's the issue, the sufficiency of the record vis-a-vis the necessary findings, right?
Yes. The court here did make the necessary findings without saying the letter and the number. And I think that from my experience in the appeals that are coming up with DJW, that's often the argument, is the court didn't say the number and the letter. They didn't say the magic words that the appellant thinks the court needs to make. But there's no requirement that they do that. As long as they reference the standard and they make the adequate findings, DJW is met. In the event that this court finds that the circuit court did not comply with DJW, I would ask that a harmless error standard be applied. The Court of Appeals, as well as this court, has held that harmless error standard of review does apply in Chapter 51 cases. This court has never held that in terms of DJW, which is what I am asking it to do now.
Doesn't that, as your opposing counsel advances, nullify DJW?
I don't think it does. I think DJW lays out what needs to be met, and if the court finds it doesn't, then that harmless error standard still comes in and says was there enough in the record to recommit this individual? Because, again, Chapter 51 is a treatment statute. There's a reason that these individuals are subject to recommitment hearings. It's because they have a mental illness, they're a proper subject for treatment, and they've been dangerous. And I think that applying that harmless error standard helps balance the statute's goals of protecting individuals and public safety and also affording individuals rights under the statute. In this case, Michael has not argued that the findings weren't there to support a finding of dangerousness. Michael only argues that the court didn't say specific things that he thinks that they should have said in complying with DJW. In the Court of Appeals, harmless error, when it has been applied to DJW violations, they have found that any error is harmless when a subject fails to challenge the sufficiency of the evidence. And that is the same here. There's no challenge to the sufficiency of the evidence. It's just a challenge to the form of what DJW, or what they think DJW needs to be. So if harmless error is applied in this case, any error that the circuit court may have made was harmless. There are plenty of facts in the record that support that Michael continued to be dangerous to himself and others due to impaired judgment as a result of his treatment record. When you review the record and the treatment record, it shows that.
So based on your argument, I think that would nullify DJW. There's no need to say what the specific section is because you're either going to have the facts in the record or you're not going to have the facts in the record. I don't see how what you just argued to us gives DJW any teeth at all.
I think that the court still needs to comply with DJW. If it doesn't comply, then it has to go to this harmless error. And if it still encourages circuit courts and tells them, you need to do this. And if they don't do that, we're going to apply harmless error. And I do think oftentimes if DJW is violated, there probably will be some sort of deficiency in the facts that this court can rely on.
Why? There wasn't in DJW necessarily. It had to do with it was very unclear in DJW what the issue was on appeal, what the court was finding. There were two or three possible sections that would have applied. And so the whole idea behind DJW was that we want to be able to give individuals an opportunity to know what they're being committed of under due process and to be able to challenge that. And what you're saying is it doesn't matter because you just would go back and say, oh, well, there's plenty in the record anyway. It doesn't really matter. It's harmless error. It doesn't matter if the court complied with DJW. So I'm hearing those two things, and I can't reconcile those.
Sure. If DJW, I think, has been interpreted by the Court of Appeals to often mean the circuit court needs to say the specific statute number in the specific section. And if that's what this court finds is required of DJW, then the harmless error would come in and say, okay, you didn't do that, but it's clear that it was under this statute. This is what the facts say. This is what the number says, just because the court failed to say those specific letters and numbers.
Well, and in DJW, you had a specific argument. At oral argument, the county conceded that it only relied on one specific paragraph and that it was never, and counsel conceded, it was never a Fifth Standard case. So we were analyzing it in terms of their argument, which was whether it was that one specific standard that was satisfied, and also the testimony, the specific testimony in that case that was completely lacking. So DJW was not as clear, perhaps, as some of my colleagues might think it was, because maybe if it were that clear, I might not have joined it. It was very specific to its facts.
Yes, and I think here this case is very different from DJW when you look at the facts. Again, there was only one standard that has been relied upon throughout this entire proceeding. Neither side has argued for anything differently, unlike DJW, where it wasn't clear what standard was being alleged and where the Court of Appeals found an entirely different standard. I would like to move on to the appropriate remedy. I would ask that this Court not create a universal remedy for Chapter 51 defects. If a commitment is expired and this court overturns the commitment, the proper remedy is reversal, and that's the case here. So should the court find that either EJW applies retroactively or the court violated DJW or that harmless error does not apply, then outright reversal is appropriate. And this court has long made clear that when a commitment is expired, the circuit court no longer has competency to act. However, nothing in Chapter 51 would require an outright reversal. All Chapter 51 requires is that the circuit court hold a hearing on the petition for recommitment before the previous order expires. Nothing suggests that the circuit court automatically loses competency if the higher court comes in and calls into question its decision. I think that...
When would that happen? Like, I'm just trying to figure out when, because Ms. Sanders-Drazen on the other side talked about, right, these cases taking 9 to 10 months. I'm just trying to figure out how would, can you give me a for instance? Like, I'm not seeing when that would happen.
When it would be appropriate for remand?
Right, when the underlying commitment had not expired, because usually the recommitment hearings are with, you know, a week or two, sometimes only before the underlying commitment has expired, and then the litigation is all about the recommitment. The underlying commitment is way over by then, so can you give me a for instance?
I don't think that the court's competency is tied to the underlying commitment, the initial commitment. I think it has competency for that recommitment hearing. As long as it holds, meets the statutory timelines, it has competency for the recommitment. And so in this case, for example, when this case was before the Court of Appeals, there were still 4 months left on the order. And if the Court of Appeals would have said EJW applies retroactively, it could have remanded for a new jury trial.
But what if, okay, so what you're saying is even if the underlying commitment order has expired and there is litigation on the recommitment order and the court finds that that recommitment order was unlawfully issued, that at that point we could still remand this unlawful order back?
Yes, I don't think there's anything in the statute that says that the court loses competency as soon as a court of appeals says it's unlawful. And I would note that in no other, you know, realm of law do we say as soon as the court says it's unlawful, it's done. It's outright reversal. You can't go back. In criminal cases, outright reversal.
There aren't these timelines. I mean, there aren't these timelines in criminal cases. There's
sure.
So I don't know that that example is going to work.
You know, often when we have these cases where a commitment order runs out, there's already been a new commitment proceeding for the same person that's already gone through the circuit court again. So we kind of have overlapping orders. Apparently, that was not the case for Michael. There was not another commitment proceeding started.
Correct. That there was not a recommitment after. There was the initial 6-month commitment, this 12-month commitment, and then there has been no subsequent order since then.
Okay. So in the blank period where there could have been another order, there was not here.
Right.
What do we do when there is?
The court has competency to act under the new order. I think that in that situation, if there's a new order in place, the prior order would be expired, and so outright reversal in that instance would be appropriate. I just don't think that there's anything in the statute that says outright reversal is always appropriate, even if an order is not expired.
Okay. Thank you.
And just speaking briefly on the practical considerations of a remand, Chapter 51 always has tight timelines. That's what we deal with every day in these cases. You have 72 hours to hold a probable cause hearing, 14 days to hold the final hearing. At most, you have 21 days to prepare for the recommitment hearing. So anything that needs to be heard on remand within the small amount of time that may be left on an order can be heard, and we can make that work in these cases because that's what we always have to do. So again, I would just ask that this court not find that there is a universal remedy in these matters. think I have anything else to add. If there are no other questions, my light's about to turn.
All right. Thank you. Rebuttal?
Thank you. Several times, Attorney Reynolds noted that this is a treatment statute we're dealing with. That is true. It's also a statute that results in a deprivation of bodily autonomy, sometimes physical liberty. This is not pure help that people are getting. It's help as well as significant freedom taken away. And because of the significant freedom taken away, we have these incredibly strict rules, these timelines that produce results that, for example, as Attorney Reynolds suggested, in the criminal context would be unthinkable. A complete loss of competency, outright reversal, in situations where, in a criminal case, you would simply have a reversal and things would go back to the trial court and proceed. That problem in Chapter 51, that experience of the subject losing their freedom, is sort of the thread that ties together a lot of both the strict rules and the remedies that have been afforded for their violation. And I would ask this court to keep that very, very close at heart when considering the harmless error rule and the remedy that should apply for any number of deprivations in the Chapter 51 context. Another point that Attorney Reynolds made is that nowhere in the statute does it say outright reversal is always the remedy. It certainly doesn't. The statute does not tell us what the remedy should be in these situations. The statute also does not provide a timeline for proceeding post-reversal, post-remand. There is nothing in the statute that appears to contemplate this situation. And on the one hand, I'm tempted to say this is a legislative problem, that the legislature needs to add a section and clarify these things. On the other hand, I think it is almost literally impossible for a Chapter 51 case to get through the whole appellate process in time to get remanded back for a new trial, a new extension hearing, whatever it is, competency aside. Logistically, it just isn't going to happen almost ever. And one of the, one of our main problems is that remitter takes time. Another problem mentioned earlier, the fast track calendar is not available everywhere. It's not available if corporation counsel vetoes it. It's not available if you have too many issues, if you're unwilling or unable to meet the word limit, a lower word limit. It's often not available. And if it's not available, then you're proceeding under ordinary timelines, and ordinary timelines are often extended. And once you get it to the Court of Appeals, there simply is no saying when they'll be able to issue the decision. Then you've got those 31 days for remitter. What if there's a motion to reconsider? That delays things further. What if there's a petition for review? What if there's litigation in this court? There are all sorts of reasons that this can be delayed. The appellate process can be delayed. But even when things move quickly, they just tend to take too long. So I sort of wonder what a ruling from this court saying reversal or remand for a new trial would do, because 9.9 times out of 10, that's not going to be an option. And so what wheels are going to be put in motion for no purpose? It strikes me that there may be some wasted resources along the way trying to initiate a new trial that simply will not come to pass because time limits are, even if you're forgetting about the old commitment and you're focusing on the expiration of the new commitment, time limits are just not long enough to accommodate a new trial.
Counsel, I have one quick question. If we agree with you that EJW should have a retroactive effect, we don't need to reach the DJW issue that you've raised, correct?
Brian, Justice Hagedorn, it was difficult to hear your question. Maybe you could state it a little louder and clearer for us.
Sure. Is this a little clearer?
I think so. Hope so. Okay. Let's try. Right.
I think what he was, I think I can summarize it.
That's okay. Let's let him ask his question.
Yeah, sure. Sorry, I'll try to speak loudly. Hopefully you can hear.
That's better.
If we agree with you on EJW, that it should have a retroactive effect, we don't need to reach the DJW separate issue that you raise, correct?
That is absolutely correct. The DJW issue is secondary to the EJW issue. If reversal is warranted on one, you need not reach the second. I also wonder, you know, the DJW harmless error issue, which is really the issue, although my red light is on, so I'm just going to finish.
Go ahead. We had a little glitch there.
The harmless error element of the DJW issue is really where this court needs to weigh in, and if this court finds no DJW violation, then there's no law development there anyway. So in conclusion, yes, if you resolve the EJW issue in Michael's favor, there's no need to go further other than to address the remedy. And thank you very much.
Thank you. Is that it, Justice Hagedorn?
Yeah, nothing further from me. Thanks, Chief.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for oral argument this morning. The court will adjourn. We'll reconvene as soon as the second case is ready for us.